Today is Tuesday, May 16th, 2023. This is part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Scott spells his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. All is well. It's a sunny, gorgeous day here in Santa Cruz, not far from the beach, and I'm happy to give what I know of my experience down in Grand Canyon to you.
Super. And thank you. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, that's fine.
Super. Thank you. Last time, you had mentioned that you'd started to work for the Museum of Northern Arizona, based out of Flagstaff, Arizona, in roughly 1977, sort of the mid-1970s there, moving into 1980. A lot of science trips on the river. You mentioned Steve Carruthers and a little bit of Kent Grua and George Billingsley. And there's a rapid in the Grand Canyon that is called MNA Rapid. Are you aware of how that was named and how all that came about?
Absolutely. I was there when it all happened. And if anything, it made sense to name it that rapid because that was upon a January river trip that we were doing for MNA as a scientific trip. And we came upon, after Tiger Wash, in 24 and a half mile rapid and other stuff that was just above it, but we went through Tiger Wash and we were on pretty low water. And it hadn't really affected anything out of the norm from Lee's Ferry down to there yet. We hadn't seen anything that later on would really give us some trouble. So I happen to know that MNA Rapid was made just a little before we got actually to that rapid, because our friends had kayaked and they started on that kayak trip in the winter. It was illegal, but they wanted to do it and they were out in front of us. And they told me, my friends that had done this, they had told me that no, they didn't see anything odd at where this rapid had just been made. So it was in between them putting on and making it that far to us arriving at that spot. And when we got there, in just below Tiger Wash, we were, you know, Steve had his boat, I had my boat. There may have been at that time another smaller boat running with us, but it was right at the beginning of all the M&A stuff for me. And so we came down, we were coming down, and I had caught up with Steve, which we weren't spread out much at all, but I caught up and he was off to the side in an eddy, sort of around Tiger Wash. And I go, well, that's odd. Why is he over there on the far right side? We're just running down to Basie's Paradise and anything. I was like, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I passed him and said, what's up? And I think it went sort of like, you know, well, look at what's below us. And I, you know, wasn't looking downstream as it's always pretty much flat there for many, many miles.
Mm-hmm.
I looked and I go, oh, wow. I think there must have been a rock fall here. And there was these great spires of block sitting basically in the middle, from wall to wall, basically in the middle of all that. And I said, oh, something came off of these walls and made this recently. And so I parked in on the left side and tied off and walked along the cliff, which I'd never done before, which was really, really fun to be in Marble Canyon and on these really fresh red wall, clean walls, walking along the river. And there was dust and there was shattered pebbles of rocks on the sides, sort of where all this stuff tumbled off the walls and crashed out into the river. And so then we sat there trying to figure out, it had actually, in a lot of respects, had blocked the river and the routes down to it and below it. And so we looked at it, and I think we figured out a safe way. I think I might have even pulled in on a safe way to, like, come upon the multiple huge boulders right there. And I might have even walked out on those rocks. But there was something to do with we got around it, and that may have been stalling some of our downstream movement up against one of the boulders out there. And we all eventually got through it, and it was so remarkable that, you know, I had done a number of trips at this time in the Grand Canyon, and I had never, none of us on the trip had ever seen it, but for sure I had the experience, and to know that this was historic in river running for Grand Canyon, that these boulders had come off the red wall and were sitting out pretty much trying to dam up the channel through there. And that may have been something to do with the water levels, but you never get to see that rapid until there's really low water, which, you know, may come with drought and so forth. You'll see that. But we got by it, and it was a thrill to see something brand new that really will affect river running. It really will affect bigger boats, motor rigs, and all that. And then when this was all done, I went up to Fred Burke's bar and cafe, and there was a picture of it, of the rapid. And I think he had taken a fixed-wing plane, or he'd heard about this somehow, or a helicopter, and took a picture of what it looked like. But him running motor rigs, he wanted to find out what the heck was going on, because that was going to affect shortly the river season, and that would really have stopped them if something didn't happen to move those boulders. Mm-hmm. It was going to block up a lot of trips. So that was really interesting to get off the river and see a picture of it, actually, as I don't think we had the smarts to make a picture of it. I don't recall. And I photographed a lot of stuff. I don't think I photographed that. I think we were pretty serious about trying to get our boats safely past this and carry on with the trip. But it was quite thrilling to see that we were on a 3-4 week trip, and here we are possibly dammed up unless the water really came up high. It was interesting to see, wow, I never expected this to happen on a river trip, and we would have had no way to really get out. How in the hell would we get out if we, there was no like trail or canyon nearby to crawl out and get up to, you know, Pierce Ferry, and not Pierce Ferry, but get up to the put-in area.
Right.
But we figured out how to get by it safely, and we did so, whether it was we pirouetted off of boulders and then stuck them through between the rocks there. But it was a thrill to see it, and it was thrilling to negotiate and get around it. And at that point, no doubt about it, we earned the opportunity to name that as M&A Rapid, the first new rapid that could have blocked a lot of river drifts down there until the water moved it or the water got way above those boulders. That's basically M&A. It stumped us and stalled us for a while, and we walked around and looked at it and figured out how we could do it, and we solved the problem. As you have to do on a lot of river trips, you come up against lots of situations where it's brand new and you've got to juggle and figure out how you're going to do this and that. And that's what we came upon. And that was the last time I really got to see it. And it never had either low enough water or the rocks move. But I believe it's probably still there. They were pretty big boulders and sharp.
There are still some big boulders there today.
Really?
And you have to kind of weave and dodge your way to get through them. And at low water, they are a good surprise. And there's like, you know, there's a number of them there. You have to, you know, one over here. Oh, there's one over there.
Yeah. Interesting, because I haven't seen it. My last trips were in early 1992, I think.
Okay.
My last commercial trips were in the early 1980s. Still haven't seen it. And gosh, you're telling me that you've gotten to see it, and you were there at low enough water to see the obstacles that we were forced to negotiate through. That was very intriguing. It wouldn't have been such a big deal if we were on just normal contemporary rafts, but we were in snout rigs, and that was a lot of boat to get through those channels and safely do it, not tear tubes apart or get us stuck between a couple of boulders.
Right. Those were rowing snouts?
Yeah.
Rowing
snout rigs.
Okay.
So, so that I'm glad you threw that in, because I did never get to have the opportunity to see it in what I would call like normal times, you know, just as, oh, you know, we run this rapid. Oh, we got to go down and run M&A, and then we got to go down to here, and we'll stop at Silver Grotto. You know, it was not normal for us. It was not normal, but
right.
You got to see it when it was normalized.
Well, yeah, but I wonder if some of the rocks didn't get moved around, maybe readjusted a little bit, whether it was worse at the time, and you've mentioned Fred Burke, who was part of not Western, that was Jack Curry, but Arizona River Runners, is that right?
Fred Burke was what was he? That name doesn't ring a bell like Western does and
okay.
Patch does. I don't recollect right now what his name of that company was, but he was out of Vermilion's Cliff Bar and all that.
Okay.
He had his warehouse up there behind all that. But it was interesting. Maybe the message got out at Phantom. Maybe the message, I don't know how the message got out, but to go in the bar and see a picture of that.
Hmm.
He was interested enough to find out what damage it was going to cause him and all trips that had big boats.
Right.
He got up and took an aerial photo of it, and that was pretty neat to see that.
Yeah.
And I just wish I had taken a picture of it. I had my movie camera and I would have shot that, but it was too much. It was too heavy. We needed to figure out a way around it, through it, and. That was the main concern at that point, was dealing with this thing.
Cool.
So,
cool.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that there was a trip in front of you that didn't have a permit. Was that
yeah.
Pete Wynn's kayak trip?
Yeah.
I think he talked about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you and I talked about it.
No, Pete and I did. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, good. Okay. Good. So, Peter, I knew... Because I asked him, you know, if he wanted to go on the and row on the. This is probably a January trip that we're talking about, and I asked him if he wanted to come, and he had stashed a bunch of hard-boiled eggs and food at various spots down the Colorado before they did all this. But then he and Dan Marshall put in at least very maybe the night. You might know better right now than I do, but. He put in, and so I knew he was out in front of us, and so when we got off where I could talk to him, I told him the M&A story, and he agreed there was nothing there when he went through, so
okay.
That gave a time mark for that.
Cool. Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was, you know, how unexpected is that you have somebody illegally jumping in the river, running down, and you actually have, you know, some history of maybe when that thing fell, and... Yeah, he marked it.
Yeah, yeah, between his trip and your trip.
Exactly.
Very neat.
Absolutely.
Very neat.
And it could have been within that, I can't recall, but it wouldn't have been out of the ordinary that it could have been just a matter of a few days. They started and then we started. And I didn't pay attention. I just knew he was going to do it. And at that point, it was all about our trip, not thinking about what they were up to.
Right.
But I knew that when we hit M&A, I go, oh, I bet you Peter went through this. And I'll have to talk to him about, was that there?
Hmm.
And in talking to him, it was, he didn't see anything like that. That wasn't there. So.
Okay.
Then when seeing all the dust and the shards on the red wall, little walkway I walked on,
mm-hmm.
I knew that, wow, this thing is, I may have even seen still dust in the air. I remember something about that. It's like, it was violent enough and big enough that whatever it crashed upon, it was still dusty, and the chips hadn't been washed away yet on the sides, on the left side anyway.
Right. Well, all that's been washed away now. The dust and the small debris, certainly monsoons come through and just kind of, you know, clean that up. But
and 83 would have wiped it out, the floods of 83.
Yeah, that's true, up to a certain level. But, of course, the dust and the chips and all would have been higher up than that. You know, up to the slide where the rock came from, up on some cliff somewhere. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah. So that's M&A, that all that I can say.
Okay.
You know, really.
And
I was happy that, you know, it was a legitimate naming of a rapid, unlike maybe subsequent rapids have been renamed or people add this and that to that campsite and whatever, which is more, I think, a part of their own ego or their all their own, like, oh, wow, this is a name. We should name it this or that, which seems to me as I... my history in various rivers, having names changed by a new batch of boatmen coming through wanting to put their mark on something.
That's right. That's right.
Do you understand that?
Yeah. Sure.
And I see that, and I just go, oh, what's this rapid called? And they go, oh, this is Mary's Rapid, or whatever. There's no history.
Right.
Here was a legitimate name that had a story to it.
Right.
And anything about, oh yeah, we're the research trip and wow, let's name this because it isn't named yet and they're making the map soon and we should have our name on it. It was nothing like that. It was like, for real, we came upon it and the story that I've told of negotiating it and worrying about what bigger rigs, how would they get through, and we got to figure out how ourselves to get through because ours are big boats. And so when it was all done, it was a for real name. It was a properly attached name to something that was really significant that had yet to be, you know, crystal happened, flooded, changed maybe a minor rapid into a disastrous rapid.
Right.
That was, you know, that was an issue, you know, whoever came upon that. And in fact, when I ran my first crystal runs, the method with Peter, when he was my trainer, he said, oh, just line up, get dead center on it, line up, and just have everybody hang on, and you hit that hole, and it's going to be just a huge explosive experience when you're going to drop down the upper wall, down into the hole, and you're going to look up a big major wall with a big rooster tail that you're going to bust through. So you just want to hit it straight and hang on. And, well, I didn't know any other way to run crystal, but later things probably changed, or there's no way I was going to run all these different water levels. I was going to line up and hit like Georgie just going for it. No way. There's safer ways to run that rapid than hang on, and we're going to explode through this thing. So,
and Crystal, of course, was called Crystal before the 1960s flash that changed it. But M&A was not there, as you say. It was below Tiger Wash. There was nothing there but flat water, or a run out below a little riffle behind you.
That's right.
And that was that. So this was definitely a new feature in the river where there had been none. Not even a riffle sort of thing.
Exactly. That's what was so stunning. When I came down from the 24s or whatever, and I saw Steve pulled over to the side, it just didn't make sense. Nothing made sense. Then I looked downstream, or he motioned, like, look at that. And I looked, as I'm coming down on it. And I go, whoa, wow, that is new. And so at that point, it was all about getting my boat to the left side shore and tying off. And, you know, it would have been a really bad deal if you didn't stop and look at what you had to do.
Hmm.
And you tried to just keep going forward, you know, like it's below Tiger Wash Rapid or something like this. But it looked so ominous that was my first thought. After I saw it, Steve was safe on the right side upstream, and I went down on the left side so I could look at the rapid. I could park the boat and walk up and down, and we could all just be safe on that wall and just admire what we were seeing and
cool.
And figure out how to get around it. So.
Scott, can you talk a little more about the science that M&A was doing at the time
sure.
on the river?
Yeah, so that's my job with M&A was to coordinate the trips, plan the trips, basically when we would go out on our three-week trips, how many throughout the year. And then all that was about the grant and having all the biotic concerns of the Grand Canyon, also beaches, campsites, making a list of all the bugs down there, all the mammals we saw down there, all the birds we saw down there. So we had various scientists come from different disciplines and so forth on my trips, and they would come on. So there might be six scientists on my boat or throughout the multi-boat trip, which was then two boats probably, and then a third smaller boat. And one trip would have somebody trying to figure out where campsites were, how many there were, how much sand was being washed off a specific area. So they would measure that as best they could. And we'd have people that wanted to stop and check out what kind of fish were in these side canyons and Little Colorado and all that. And I just remember, now here I am just a boatman with a lot of prior knowledge as to what was going on in the canyon that they, the scientists, had no idea. They had never been in the Grand Canyon. Basically, nobody had been there. And I also, amongst all this, a part of my job was to go on flights down the canyon and photograph the Colorado at different water levels and try and gather up info on what campsites look like, maybe at different water levels, or give an idea to the person doing the studies on campsites, the availability, how many there were, and an estimate of this and that. So I flew for that, and then one of my particular trips, I think it was my single boat trip that we had talked about earlier. And the guy on that trip was from maybe Louisiana or Ohio or someplace, and he would have been better off going to Las Vegas and gambling than down there trying to figure out stuff. And he showed me, he had me pull in with that big heavy boat, and that was my single boat trip. So it was a heavy boat, and he'd say, okay, my map shows we're coming up to campsite number this and that. And I'd go, there is no, I've never camped in what you're calling, and there is no camp there.
Hmm.
And that went on constantly on our trip. Constantly.
Huh.
And at that point, the idea of slapping a motor on the back of a snout rig, which would have been possible, which is what I ultimately ended up doing at the end of my time with M&A, converting my boat to a boat that could handle that motor back there. But he had me going in and out of current, into eddies, stopping, letting him walk around, hopping back on the boat, him making notes. And, yeah, I got it looks like on my maps, which were aerial photographs, not mine, but they were maps at a low water time, which did happen throughout my experience. It just isn't a one-time fluke that there's low water. There's sometimes the dams just didn't even have the water to do it, so the water dropped. And then when they had water, they released it. So he had photographs of the Colorado at pretty low water, and all these sandy, beautiful beaches were up. So he was going like, well, I've got like 350 campsites down here, and this all has to do with the number of people that motor rigs or rigs, where they could put them all down there. And it was right at the time when ore rigs were like, we're going to go no more motors. It's only going to rowing boats. They don't take as many people. The motor rigs are carrying all these people down there. And it was sort of like a justification in a way to like favor the rowing trips. There'll be more campsites down there. Get as many down there as you can. Or it was get as many campsites as you can so a motor rig can handle 25 people at a campsite. Now, road trips were only like 6 or 7 people, and that was hardly impacting anything. So there was a lot going on that was involved, not only the great investigation of what animals and stuff was in the canyon, but it was also at a time when they were trying to figure out how they should monitor and control the volume of people down there and gasoline and fumes from the motor rigs. And so anyway, so yeah, the biologist, that was just a case of this one guy that had me rowing so many spots that, you know, from water I could, so this is where we're at right now. That thing is underwater right now, and it's not very much water we're running on. You know, that campsite doesn't exist. That was taken at low water, and so all your numbers aren't realistic. And I was very blunt about it because I've seen so many of these biologists kind of like, I get the feel like you guys don't know what you're doing. You may be biologists, you may be water people, you may be sand erosion people, you may be this or that, but you're not listening, or you've got ideas, or you've got an idea of how you're going to do all this, and you're missing out on really what is going on down there that I see going on down there. And I had one guy that had come on a couple trips, and he was trying to measure the sand erosion, which isn't a bad idea. But so he had a staff with foot markers or inch markers on it. He'd wade out into the current as far as he could without getting floated away. And he would, mark, oh, it's this deep here. Okay, this deep here. And I'll go over here and make a note like put my staff down, and it was that deep on the sand there. And it was like things changed so fast with current and storms and runoff and dam releases. But that's the only thing he could think of to measure erosion off of these beaches was to go and get a marker as to this day, this year, this is what my staff said. It was 5 feet deep right there, or it was 2 feet deep, and that's where sand was. So. But it changed so much, and I had been in the canyon enough to see natural floods come down there from Little Colorado, from Korea, which really added a ton of sand to the craziest places. I mean, you would have the opportunity to bring your camp into utterly brand-new, sandy, huge football field-long benches of sand. You go, wow, there's no way that could get eroded. Let's camp here. We'll never get to do this again. So it was really fun to see the dynamics of flooding with really silty, sandy water and in points on cliffs and making eddies, and all that sand would drop, and then the water levels would drop, and you have this beautiful sandy beach there. And personally, I thought that there's no way the Colorado could wipe out this long a beach, even though it wasn't rooted in bushes and flowers and seedlings and grasses. It was raw, just sand. But yeah, that all got washed away as soon as time got a hold of it. There's nothing to hold it down, and it was perfect. Little Colorado, Perea, and any other sand side canyons that had flooding, that worked fantastic, but it was temporary. It didn't work long. And there you get into kind of a argument I have with the high-level flows that we're going to release from Glen Canyon, and these are made to, we're going to get the beaches, which is not really about ecology or planting bushes and saving this bush and that. It's all about getting campsites for the commercial outfitters, and it's a nice idea, I guess, but really the point is we need campsites. Our campsites are washing away.
Right.
But having watched the Little Colorado and the upstream canyons and their flow from the floods, you know, just natural floods, the afternoon big water floods, they made beaches that no dam release. And if they don't release dam water with matched with a flood of sand and mud and dirt, and you're not going to gain anything other than lose water in Glen Canyon, you know, but they have all this hoopla for we're having the big release, you know, and we're going to try and build up the sand and all that. That's a contemporary myth in my mind.
Yeah. Do you remember the name of the person you were working with that was jumping out and walking up and down and doing that campsite survey?
No. He was a short kind of stumpy kind of guy. I don't remember
okay.
his name.
All
but
right.
it was he was from Middle America or New Orleans, Louisiana, something like that. And maybe Carruthers knows.
I'm just wondering where that data set went, and the
yeah.
photos that you took at low level yeah. flying the canyon, was that M&A photos? Were they? Is that where those went?
You know, I believe. You know, it was. I took a lot of photos. I don't remember if it was funded by M&A. I wouldn't be surprised if it was, but it was very difficult. A friend, Phil Shoemaker, was a pilot on all this.
Okay.
And he had rented, I guess we had rented, I don't think we used his plane, but we rented a plane that I could take the side doors off.
Oh.
So I could have no impediment with hanging out and taking shot after shot. Yeah. And so that was interesting, but it was so difficult for me to keep track of where we were in our flight and make a note of it with the camera. Like, you know, maybe now with a camera, you could have done it, a digital thing, and you could have manipulated or tag certain things easier than, you know, a reel of, you know, movie camera film, and being able to go, oh, at this time in the film is where I shot South Canyon, or
right.
this is where I shot Carbon Creek, or this is where that was really impossible.
Hmm.
That's what I found up there, and I think we all found out that, you know, the pictures weren't. They weren't either good enough or sense. It didn't make sense. I mean, I could never have made sense. Even if I got to look at all the footage, I could have maybe done a bad job of it, but it was very difficult to, in the flight, to note where you really were now, unless there was some big figure at Basie's was pouring or you came to a rapid that you were familiar with. It was really hard
right.
to keep track of all that.
Huh.
And so I think we kind of, it was an experiment,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
As I recollect, when it was all run through the process and developed, they said, you know, yeah, we can't use it. We can't tell with the plane, which banks and goes straight and climbs to get over something and down, and it says, yeah, it just didn't work. It didn't work. I don't know where all that stuff is now, or I don't know if anybody would be left at M&A to even know anything about where that went, or if it went to the Park Service.
Right.
No idea.
Huh.
I don't know. Yeah. So and it would have just been a bunch of I would guess a rattly bunch of film from the rocking around in the plane and turning on the plane and keeping track of where you were up in the air, and you would think that it wouldn't be hard, but it's hard to keep track of the filming and keep track of exactly where you are and looking, you're going, oh, wow, there's that. Oh, yeah, there's that canyon. Oh, but we're past this. It was, like, really difficult to do. But it was fun to fly. Fun to fly all over the place.
And I bet. And it only would have been 10 years after maybe 10 or 12 or 13 years after the dam took over the flow from the river and started impounding sediment. So it's very possible that those pictures show a lot more sediment in the river corridor than is there today, or show the vegetation taking over the sediment.
True. That was not anything, as far as I remember, it was not what it was all about, because I was all about the campsite guy.
Okay.
But the value of those pictures, like you say, I mean, that was, the dam happened, and then not long after the dam and what it was going to be, the impact it was going to have on the Colorado, I was pretty close to those photos would have shown where high water was, because the tamarisks and the bushes and all that. It's pretty easy to see. I don't know if it's anymore, but it was pretty easy to go down and see where the flood level was throughout time because of how the bushes and everything worked. You know?
Interesting. So. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, you mentioned a fellow, George Billingsley.
Yeah.
Can you tell me when did you first meet George and what did you guys do together?
Yeah, George Billingsley was a geologist working at MNA, and so I was working at MNA, and so we would talk, and if I wasn't, he would never be on the river with me, because he had his own things going on, but he had his own geology projects, and at that time, George, I would get to go on trips with George and Jim Sears. He was also another one that worked as probably a hired hand.
How do you spell Jim's last name?
I think it's S-E-A-R-S, Sears.
Thanks.
Jim Sears.
Okay.
And Jim was... a paid biologist, I'm sure. George was working for MNA, and so they would bring on geologists to help. I mean, there's a lot of work covering Western Grand Canyon. And they were saying, well, something to the effect, well, it's not been mapped out there, and we're gonna map it all, and we're going to do, I think even geology of the Grand Canyon was being done with all that as well. Geology, where the Coconino stops, started to peak starts and stops, where Redwall, all that rock was being figured out and put on that map, a geologic map. Billingsley, this was all at the beginning of making these maps. And I go, it can't be possible that nobody's got information on the Western Grand Canyon. Sure enough, I went on to an old map. And it was kind of like they just said in the center of the whole blob of country, Grand Canyon, unknown, something like, it probably wasn't this, but it's like unknown properties of the western edge of the Grand Canyon. It was out, I think at that time, it was probably outside of any national park status. But anyway, that was all. So I would hike with these guys, George. And then one time, George says, we're going to go out to 209 Mile Canyon, and we've got to crawl up the canyon and make sure that this and that had happened. It's a part of some other bigger canyon routes or whatever, or creeks. But for whatever their reason was, they needed to go out and prove what they had gotten from aerial photographs. That was a part of it, too. There were aerial photographs that they had done, or that was in the books already from flights And so that brought us over to the 209 Mile Canyon, and that had access to the road, all dirt roads. George and I and a couple other folks, I can't recollect who came with us, but we took the old M&A white carry-all van out there on a road that was not a road. It was mostly rocks and gullies and all this other stuff. But we finally made it. We went onto that road from Fredonia or from Kanab, something like that.
Is this like the Kelly Point Road out on the Shivwitz Plateau? And so did you hike into 209 from the rim?
No, we drove virtually to the almost to 209 Mile Canyon.
Oh, on the Esplanade.
Yeah, probably what would have been the Esplanade. Yeah.
From the Parashant area, from Whitmore, kind of generally, Andrus Canyon, that side.
Yeah, we were by Parashant and. I remember when we went out, we had to basically find out where we were from where the volcanoes were. So we were going by all these that I'd never seen before, but we're driving on this funky road, and you could see the lava flows and the what was left of volcanic action.
Got
out
it.
There.
Okay.
And so we're bumping along, and this funky van was on its last leg. And here we are 100 miles from the main highway up there in whatever it was, Fredonia or Kanab. And all of a sudden it acted funny, and then we popped the hood and we looked at the engine, and the distributor on the engine was spinning in its place. And
oops.
Some mechanics, I looked at that and I go, I've never seen that, you know. And at the bottom of a distributor, you know, it's got a gear down at the bottom that engages the camshaft or whatever. The whole thing was moving, and we had something was happening funny with the truck.
Huh.
And so we had to check into it. And I don't know if we decided that screwing it down, because that would have had a bolt to tighten it down. I don't know if we fixed it just simply by that, or it was just a guess. And then we did it. And that got us farther and nearer to a 9 Mile Canyon. And there was a barbed wire out there and an old mining cabin out there as we were getting closer.
Okay.
And you understand that?
Yeah, like a line shack. An old,
yeah,
you bet.
And it was cold. And we had snow flurries out there. So Here we were with a funky truck and a distributor that wanted to fly out through the hood and stuff us out there. Well, it couldn't get us, but what did get us was the fact that the road was virtually non-existent row, and it was full of cobbles and different sized boulders in the way. And we hit one of those boulders right when we got into that miner shack or electrical people or a rancher that had done something. This is really out in the middle of nowhere. And we broke the front end axles, the steering component. There's a name for all that stuff that hangs down under your car. And it's a part of steering. It's a part of the framework, hydraulics. Well, we hit a big boulder, and we broke that. It was cast iron, and we broke it, and the whole truck fell on the ground.
Oh, gosh.
And here, we couldn't have been farther out. We could not have been farther away unless we would hike down the bottom of 209 Mile Canyon and lost our boats that we were going to use to get farther down and off to Colorado.
Hmm.
We were like way out, and we just dropped the whole truck on the ground, undrivable. And it was snowing, and we ended up spending the night in the cabin, the miner cabin. And in the morning, we couldn't deal with that. As I recollect, we couldn't deal with such a major problem this late in the day. An unrunning vehicle, trying to figure out how far it's going to be if we have to walk out of here, and can we walk out of here? Do we have enough provisions to walk out of here? It's snowing now. You know, we're not set up to be broken down out here. This is all with George Billingsley. It was, he putting this whole trip to 209 together. So George was there. Probably Jim Sears was there. Maybe another person was there. And so we've got a truck that's on the ground, and we went and ate. And George always, like, ate, built a fire and threw a can of beans on it or a can of hash on it or, you know, something simple. He was so wonderfully simple about, if we're going to go on a hike, just throw in a few more cans of sardines or whatever. Throw some salami in, you know, or and some crackers. You know, it was like no energy thrown to the cooking chefs of anything out there. It was all, whatever's easy, boom, done, we're gone. Right now, off we go. And so we got out there, made a fire, heated up whatever food we had. And in the morning, we looked around, and there was luckily barbed wire that was set up. And we found some sticks that were strong enough and shaved enough, weathered enough or whatever, that we were able to jack up the frame of the vehicle and use barbed wire and this stake of just raw wood, but it fit what we needed to do. And we pounded it in to where the front forks and all that would have been to hold the front end up. Huh. We pounded it in and used barbed wire to hold it together up to whatever parts of the truck were available and sturdy. So we were able to, like, jack up the car, jack up and get the car off the ground, and then tie it all together with the barbed wire and this slight log that we had found. And at that point, we backed it up, and I walked much of it, pulling boulders off of the trail and kind of like, yeah, it'd be better if you go on the left side here, go on the right side. I need somebody to help. This is a big boulder. We need to get that one out of the way.
Hmm.
That's how we went until we reached whatever, the 80-something highway that's out there. You'll know. It's not 89.
Yeah, the road between Hurricane and Fredonia.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah.
We finally got there, and it took forever to get there. Our work in suspending the suspension worked, and we went really super slow. And myself and somebody else was out in front, always moving boulders out of the way, directing where we should go. And we just limped our way back and then drove home to Flagstaff.
Oh, my gosh.
Happy children. And I wouldn't doubt that we bought some whiskey and celebrated, but it was that kind of a moment. We were just like, wow, we made it. I can't believe it. We did it, you know. And, you know, it's almost just another one of those moments when you're a boatman, you got to solve flipping problems or people hung up on rock problems or M&A rapid problems. This is just another one of those, fuck, we are stuck. I mean, we're so far away. Winter is on its way. We're getting snowed on. It's cold. And we've got to get somehow everything back onto the highway and back to Flagstaff. And so when we got to the point where we could drive, and the truck did well back to Flagstaff, and so it was a happy moment. And I never went back to 209 mile. I always looked at it when I went by and remembered what had happened. But so that was one of my trips with George Billingsley. And then...
So George worked for the USGS.
True.
And he was a boatman for Grand Canyon Expeditions, yep. I think, out of Kanab.
That's correct.
And he got...
Motor rigged on that.
Yeah, he was like...
And his wife motor rigged, too.
Oh, okay.
His wife.
Oh, all right.
She ran boats, motor rigs, too.
Susan?
Susan did was on the water, too, as a guide.
Okay.
Running the motor rig. Yeah, she was one of the gals, of the few gals that were not honored, but were proved that they could do a man's job out there. And this was at a time when there were no women out there doing
it. So, Georgie was out there.
Only one, probably.
Well,
Georgie, the only one.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of who. Teresa Yates. When did Teresa? She probably a little later. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there weren't many, that's for sure.
In fact, Louise Teal wrote a book on women of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
I've got right now.
Right.
And I got it from Amazon just recently.
Cool.
I've got a new one somewhere that I buried. But anyway, it's got a whole list of the women that broke in
okay.
and were competent, capable guys out there, and little stories about them all. It's a good book for that purpose there.
Cool.
So, but anyway, yeah. So Billingsley, your focus on Billingsley, he worked for USGS, he worked for the geology.
And he USGS. Worked with Stan Buse, Dr. Stanley
yeah.
Buse, out of the geology department
M&A.
At Northern Arizona University.
Yes, NAU.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. They probably corroborated on their thoughts of, like, you know, this is happening and that's happening, and how could that happen without this going on? And, yeah, they were, you know, it was good to see working geologists not be, you know, egocentric and say, this is my idea and that's how it goes, which I saw a lot
right.
in M&A. It's like people are really boisterous about what they think is right. But you got to have an open mind that the whole thing's too complex and nobody knows still, so... Yeah.
And when
Don't
did you
yourself.
When did you leave M&A?
I left them. I stayed with them for about 6 years, so I probably left them a couple of years before the 83 floods. So
okay.
You figure out that.
80, 81. No, it's sometime right
yeah.
around in there. Yeah. And then did you
was,
go back to working commercially then?
Yeah, I went back commercially and was hired, and that's what put me out in the water to experience the 83 floods.
Was that back with ARTA or with AZRA, or was that with
AZRA,
someone else?
No, it was only AZRA.
Okay.
Only AZRA was doing it. And Jessica owned, ex-wife of Rob Elliott, she owned the company at that point and ran. I don't know what happened to Rob. I remember if he had to leave or whatever, or part of the divorce was who gets this or what. You might know more on that one.
No. Well, it's interesting because, well, somehow, he was there running the business. There must have been another transition with him back in there. I don't know how that would have happened. Huh.
Yeah, I don't know. That's
yeah.
a good question. But and
then why did you leave M&A?
When?
No, why?
Why? Oh, well, I left M&A because... the grant was expiring,
okay.
or had expired, and there was no money for me anymore, or any of the biologists.
Right, right.
That had done, and in geology department where I was working at the same time as on the river, you know, that wasn't going to happen any longer because I was under Bill Breed, and that. Was a great, we talked about this earlier, but his stipend of money that he had for workers in his branch of M&A, they probably, I was being paid from that big grant for the Colorado River.
Okay,
so
got it.
Once that was gone,
yeah.
then the geology department had to break down.
So yeah. so Bet, the whole concept of those studies was to look at how to manage the river, and there was much debate at the time to manage the river and the backcountry of Grand Canyon National Park for its wilderness character. And that, that came up with the 1979 Wilderness River Management Plan, which the river concessioners fought then in Washington, and with the help of James Watt, who they'd already hired as a lawyer and lost in court.
Oh, yeah.
In the,
yeah, James Watt was an idiot.
In the 70s. Do you remember the sentiment at the time when that was happening, what people were thinking about all that?
I'll just tell you what I've kind of hit upon earlier on all these people studying this. There was a lot of money involved in this, and so you have the outfitters that are trying to protect their business and try and get proof of there's this and that out there that can handle it. All these trips, and we are, and it was just an odd time when you're competing with, you know, wanting the canyon to be not abused but used properly and shared. But there's a whole business side, and you know, that gets back to where, oh, we need campsites because we're running out of campsites and there's no sand anymore. Well, you know, that's about the outfitters trying to keep their business running, and if there's no campsites, what do you do down there? And you know, I watched it from when there was ample. I watched it when there were, when we talked about cooking with wood all the time. There was wood stashed from ancient floods that we were using. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, this mound had it, or oh, this eddy, there should be an ancient eddy right here, and there should be wood up on this bluff right here. And that's how we found wood, and that's all from the ancient times. At the time, I had gone as a board member with Arda or Azra, and I went to some of the meetings with all these motor rig people, and people were, it was kind of like an opportunity to everybody get together and see and figure out, you know, how they could save their jobs and their business and also mitigate this and that problem with gas engines down there and too many people down there. I just remember, I can't give you any specifics other than a feeling that it was all about initially probably just saving the canyon in, you know, with quotation marks around it, saving the canyon, and being able to keep the boats going down there and keep the businesses going. And it's kind of like how the airplane flights are probably going through all that right now in Grand Canyon. I just read something in the paper about flights in the Grand Canyon and what it used to be and what it is now. And the accidents that have happened in flights hitting each other. And so I know when I was down, there were, God, it was constant, the number of flights. I mean, the tourist flights were all the time. That was really annoying. Only thing good about those tourist flights to me was that since we didn't have radios, I had a mirror that I could use to contact flights. And that worked really good, and I had to use it on one passenger that needed to be flown out. And sure enough, I'd never had to practically use it, but I had practiced with it to see, you know, how you really use the crosshairs and all this stuff and where you look at. And so I got a hold of one of the tourist flights, and he signaled with his flaps and doing a circle, maybe, whatever they do when they recognize, yes, we see you, we'll send, you know, so we'll send a helicopter out and we'll note your location. So, you know, I always felt good in a positive way about the flights for those reasons. Otherwise, they were just a nuisance. I'm glad that they did level some regulations and flight patterns that they could go on and can't go on. And then the accident happened. And so, I don't know. I think I was practical. No, I was there right then, but I don't remember anything about that. Two planes bumping into each other at Crystal somewhere.
Right.
Another thing, now we're on a flight. This will be an aside of my notes that I wrote down the other day, is that I got to see in the early, would have been in the early 70s, because my brother was on the trip, and we were at Lava on the left side, on the south side, park looking at Lava, and we heard this horrific roar, which I never saw it again, you know, a few years past this moment I'm talking about. But we go, wow, that's so loud. And we were watching the rapid, and this bombarding sound came on us, and I looked up the canyon, and sort of by the anvil up there and maybe upstream more. And there were a couple of fighter jets that had done a massive bank with their planes up against the upstream wall, going so fast. And then they came right over the top of us at Lava. And it was just an awe-inspiring spectacle to watch these fighter jets just dead deep into the canyon, up against the sides of these walls, turning and roaring past us like in a fighting combat mode. It was so intense. It just made Grand Canyon even more intense. But to see these trainers go through there, and that was still being done, but not much longer. I think probably somebody ratted it out, and it was a hot shot kind of thing for people, the pilots, to do, I'm sure.
Yes,
but it was fun to see it. It was really fun to see it. Actually, it had been talked about, but I never gotten to see it, and then I got to watch it, you know, full blown at me, coming right at our, you know, above our heads and roaring. And And here we're trying to figure out Lava, and then we're just totally fixed on this flight pattern, and like, wow, I finally got to see this. So anyway, flights in the canyon, yeah.
Yeah.
So we can move on to something else.
Well, maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series, as I think the next question I've got is 1983, and the high water.
Oh yeah.
The high water trips. Is there anything that we've covered that you wanted to tie back in that before we wrap this up?
I'm looking at my notes here.
Uh-huh. Great.
Evacuations of helicopter. Yeah, I talked about that. Let's see. Shooting case. Oh, here I have a note down here. We took shotguns down with the M&A trips, and we used them, like very typical in the biologist realm, is to kill things to prove that they existed down there, and formaldehyde or whatever. And so we had shotguns, a couple of shotguns down there, and geese were flying up canyon above Nankoweap, and there were geese around. It was wintertime, so there were geese around, and they were nesting, and it was warm in the canyon, in a way. And, I never was able to hit a geese, but I got to shoot the shotguns down in the Grand Canyon, which was totally legal. And that blew my mind. I go, wow, I've got a shotgun down here, and we're actually hunting these geese. And I think
these were hunters. Canadian geese?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Big black and white.
Your regular black and white, honk, 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 honk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and they weren't, I knew they were down there in my time, but it was here with the biologist, we had a way to kill one or two, whatever, and brought it down and stored it in the freezers to go back as a specimen of a bird that was in the Grand Canyon that they killed. And I didn't want to kill any of those things that they were always killing. But that's what biologists, I understand, do, is to prove that it existed.
Right.
They had to kill it and put it in a jar.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Along with that, I'll just have a quick note, and you can stop me if you go, no, that's a whole other story. But finding the humpback chub at Little Colorado was, I thought, pretty anticlimactic. I didn't know anything about fish in Little Colorado. I could care less about humpback chub, I'd never heard of. And just to be dangling our legs off in the water, hanging out before we went somewhere else. And with the fish people, with staffs and nets out in the Little Colorado upstream, poking around with their sticks and nets, flushing the fish out from under cliffs and so forth. Yeah, and they ended up getting a humpback chub or two, or a few. And they were all excited about it. I was nonplussed about it. And just like subsequent trips, after all the M&A stuff, you had to look down in the water and see chubs down there swimming around. Like, it's like, what's the big deal? You know, it's only because nobody ever looked for them that they're here. They're all over the place in this canyon, Little Colorado's canyon. But anyway, that was really interesting that. It was a big deal because they didn't think they existed, and that's a big deal for sure.
Huh.
The biologists and everybody, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
There was rumors that we took it back and cooked the humpback chub. I don't remember anything about anything like that at all. But what I do remember is that it was illegal without permit to capture a humpback chub. Of course, we had to swallow it up in a container to prove that we've had it. We found it down there. But I guess it was illegal. And we did have a radio that worked that Steve could use. And we were talking. We had flyovers like once every other week or so. We had flyovers, or there were established dates and time that there would be a flyover. We could contact them.
Okay.
And this will come into a story later on in another time. But, yeah, so we had communications up. And somehow they understood that we'd found the chub down there, and we were bringing a specimen out. And you may know better than I, but apparently that was illegal federally to get that animal and bring it out because it was protected and this and that, and it was kind of a prehistoric thing that was still left down there. And so with that, somehow the feds or the the police department with the feds or whatever it was. I heard when I got to Diamond Creek that, hey, somebody heard that we'd gotten this humpback, and they want to get us. It's just me on the boat going out, and they said you can't take out here at Diamond Creek. You got to go down to Pierce's because they're sending trucks or whatever out to bust this whole thing. And so I ended up passing Diamond with whatever folks I had on my boat and going all the way out to Pierce's and exiting, and they'd have a vehicle there and trailer and take me out. But I remember that it was kind of a joke that, wow, they knew, somebody knew on the trip that, wow, I think that's illegal, you know. Well, the feds can't hear about it, but somehow with the phone reception up to Phantom Ranch, that word got out that we found a humpback chub, and we put it in a jar or whatever we'd done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to send people out to capture. If it was on my boat, I don't know, but they sent me. They didn't take my crew and gear, whatever was wrong. I may have had it on my boat, and I went down to Pierce's and took it out. And that was the last I heard of it, but that was kind of like espionage, you know, TV material. Like, you know, we got to get out of here. And that was how it felt. You can't stay here. They could be coming down Diamond Creek. We're going to get busted. And so just keep on going. And we'll figure out how to get you at Pierce's. And we'll be there on this and that day or whatever. But anyway, that's probably all I want to add to anything.
Okay.
If that gets woven in.
So that's great. Yeah. No, thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Well,
I've got a lot of other notes on different tangents that are important, too.
Good.
But that was just...
Let's hold those thoughts. And let's bring those in next time. That'll be good. Cool.
Yeah. And I'm not by a calendar right now, but if it's a Monday or a Tuesday, I think I'm not on any camping trips yet.
Okay. So, hang on for a second. Let's wrap this up. This will conclude part 7 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Scott Imslin. Today is Tuesday, March 16th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure to go back in time, and hopefully, you know, it'll be of some use to somebody someday, and it's really kind of fun to be brought back so many years ago, and it really comes to light amazingly with as old as I am at 102, 102 years, all I am right now. So anyway.
Cool, hang on a second. Hang on a second.
Sure.